Hello, everybody. Welcome to Oncology Decoded, where cancer science meets clarity. It's Ben and I joining you all today on Oncology Decoded. We have a special episode for you all with some very important guests that we are fortunate to have today. We have Dr. Suzanne Merrill and Dr. Mark Tyson, urologic oncologists, joining Ben and I in our discussion of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. Ben, you want to start us off?
Yeah, so we'll let our colleagues introduce themselves, but first I want to say I'm just thrilled to have urologists again on the podcast. As a GU medical oncologist, urology referrals are our lifeblood, so we thank you in advance for that. But so please, Dr. Merrill, please introduce yourself. Where do you work? What's your practice like? And then we'll throw it over to our next colleague.
Well, thanks for having me aboard here. Happy to be a part of this. So I'm Suzanne Merrill. I'm a urologic oncologist by trade. And I work out in Colorado. I'm part of a practice called Colorado Urology, which is a large urology group practice, or LUGPA. And initially, I started out in academics and then made the transition out into the private sector of the world. And over here in Colorado, I help to lead our 30-plus MD group with their bladder cancer and advanced therapeutics.
Hey, my name is Mark Tyson. I'm one of the urologic oncologists here at Mayo Clinic in Arizona. My academic and clinical subspecialty interest is bladder cancer, and it's nice to see Suzanne again, and nice to meet you both.
Thank you both for joining us.
Oh, look, me and Manoj are talking over each other already, but no, it's great. No, thank you guys so much for joining us. I think, we were talking about what's the most important thing for us medical oncologists to know, right? And I think there's a lot moving in this non-muscle invasive urothelial carcinoma space. And I think the first thing that comes to mind is all of this move to think about checkpoint inhibition, systemic immunotherapy, whether through the IV or subcutaneous injection, moving into a patient with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer that's not necessarily going to go into a cystectomy or definitive chemo radiation. So we're going to let one of the two of you take a stab at their thoughts on breaking down the kind of how we got here.
Well, I'm happy to start there. Well, I think BCG is very good. So for BCG naive, non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, historically, over the last couple of decades, we've been using BCG. And in terms of its efficacy, it's pretty good. 60, 70% of people respond over the course of a couple of years, 2, 3, 4 years. But it's not perfect. And so there is room for improvement. There are side effects. There's a shortage. And so there's a number of things that in practice limit its use. And so the question I think that's emerged over the last few years is, A, can we make it better? And B, if we don't have enough of it, can we replace it with something? And so that sort of forms the basis of a number of trial concepts in this space. And so to your question about checkpoint inhibition in particular, we've seen a number of trials enter the space, Keynote 676, Potomac, and the US equivalent, Patopsco. There's Keynote 676. What am I forgetting? There's durvalumab, Crest, wesisanlimab for the subcutaneous formulation, and I think there's one more. I'm just kind of having a senior moment.
Albin's.
Yeah, the atezolizumab. Thank you. And so they all kind of vary in terms of their trial design. They're all randomized phase threes. They all have slightly different endpoints, but for the most part, they're pretty standard or very similar. And so I think what we're seeing across all those studies is there's not really a big delta in terms of efficacy. I think in Potomac, it was 5%, 4, 5, 6%, something like that. And Crest, for the intention to treat population, I think it was 6 or 7%. There are some subsets that benefited. The CIS subset in Crest, for example, had a bigger delta. But for the most part, we weren't seeing a huge difference compared to BCG. So the good news is BCG is quite effective as a monotherapy. But the question I think becomes whether, and I think Suzanne and I have, and a lot of other urologists have, is whether that efficacy, that delta in terms of benefit, is worth the systemic AEs. And so I think that's where we should park for a few minutes and talk about, because the systemic AE risk sometimes in some of these studies are, in absolute terms, 2.5 or 3 times greater than the efficacy delta.
And so just to clarify, right, efficacy delta, right? Is that overall survival? Is that event-free survival? What exactly are we drilling down to? If I give my patient with high risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, this additional therapy, X percent of patients, 5 to 7% of patients are going to be improved in what domain?
I'll jump in here. With what Mark said, with those trials, Potomac, CREST, so Potomac, durvalumab, CREST, sasanzumab, and, you know, ALBIN too, there was no overall survival benefit for the duration that we looked at those patients. And again, that's around kind of, you know, the where the data cutoff was about 36 months for both CREST and Potomac. And so of that time, you know, a lot of the question we have too, was that enough time to be able to find an overall survival for, you know, a difference between these two treatments? And so all what we found difference was either event-free survival, which was in CREST, or disease-free survival, which is generally the same kind of endpoint looking at recurrence of disease, progression to muscle invasive disease, also death, kind of a very hodgepodge, all the events or disease-related, you know, events that could have happened. And that's where we saw the difference between the addition of the checkpoint inhibitor to BCG compared to BCG induction plus maintenance. And I'll say that, you know, when they did break things down, and this is, you know, more I can speak from CREST data, that, you know, looking at what caused that delta in event-free survival in CREST between adding the checkpoint inhibitor, and it was actually a reduction in the recurrences of high-grade disease. So reducing those numbers of TURBTs the patient's undergoing. There was just too few events and changes in progression of disease, you know, difference in metastases, et cetera, to really, again, show any difference along those metrics. So it was just recurrences of disease. So one of the things that, you know, Mark and I think about, you know, again, CREST, unfortunately, with sasanzumab is not going to FDA approval right now. They halted that, but durvalumab is. And that probably will, you know, come to fruition maybe, I don't know, in June, in the next couple of months, probably. And so we're going to have these real-time discussions with patients as to, are we going to use this or recommend it, refer to medical oncology or use it within our own practices if we're administering immune checkpoint inhibitors. And it's this discussion as what Mark said, is the side effect profile. So the immune-related adverse events in Potomac were 8% seen with the addition of durvalumab. And is that worth it with that reduction in kind of the number of recurrences of high-grade disease, the reduction in the amount of TURBTs that we would put a patient through? Because we just don't have really any other, again, endpoints such as overall survival to say that there is a benefit yet to that addition of that drug.
I have a question for you, for both Mark and Suzanne, you, and just understanding your different perspectives, right? So Suzanne, when you're talking about reduction of TURBT is one of the big criteria to determine if you're going to use this or not, what other clinical criteria are you figuring, are you using in relation to what was studied versus what is clinically applicable for considering high-risk disease, right? So how are you thinking about high-risk disease for these non-muscle invasive patients, right? And does that definition really vary in clinical practice versus what is seen on patients in a clinical trial? How do you guys think about that?
I'm happy to start first, if that's okay, Suzanne. I think that the folks that we put on Patopsco, which was the U.S. version of Potomac, these were very high-risk patients that I otherwise really wanted to do a cystectomy in. Paradoxically, they were, you know, surgical candidates, 60-year-old folks who had really high-volume T1, either concomitant CIS or LVI or, you know, maybe even a little bit of variant histology, and I had recommended a cystectomy, and they didn't want to go that route for obvious reasons. A lot of people choose not to do that, and so what I like about the combination therapy with durvalumab and BCG or sasanzumab and BCG or whatever the case, pembro, is that it's a hedge against that really high risk phenotype that could potentially even be metastatic from the gate. And so, you know, if you're going to put a non-surgical foot forward, you better put your very best foot forward in that situation. And I think that I think in those situations, it could be worth the AEs. But by and large, garden variety high-risk disease that was able to be included on these trials, I don't think we should be using combination therapy. So you're just your high-grade TAs, your low-volume CISs, maybe even your low-volume T1s that you repeat the resection and there's no evidence of disease. I'm not really sure that it's worth the risk in those situations. But the patients that I'm thinking should have a cystectomy and they refuse, that might be the population that I consider using that combination therapy in.
To jump off, piggyback off what Mark said, are like the, right, the T1, CIS, high volume disease, the younger patient sometimes, right, that certainly wants to avoid cystectomy, but has these really high risk features, positive LVI in the path, repeat resection, like Mark said, again, T1 disease, so still volume of disease there. I think, you know, those are the obvious patients to us, the ones worth, like Mark said, maybe the immune-related AEs, and that want to just give it their all kind of up front. I think that's the thing we don't know, that if, you know, this seems to be a powerful, can be a powerful combination up front, reduce a lot of the quality of life factors that happen with non-muscle invasive disease and a bladder-sparing approach. But, you know, I think one interesting thing I'll bring up to kind of get the pulse of what you guys think, you know, a lot of these studies, right, do these subgroup analyses, right? And then we all know we shouldn't probably put too much weight on them, but they're, you know, kind of food for thought. Interestingly, right, with the Potomac data, it said, you know, they showed that actually, you know, high-risk papillary disease actually fared better with the combination, so immune checkpoint inhibitor, durvalumab plus BCG compared to just BCG alone. And actually CIS wasn't so much of a big, you know, contender, that, you know, maybe CIS, it didn't show a favorability for the combination. But then you look at CREST data, right, and there was a more favorable situation for our CIS patients. So again, we don't really have data from the trial. I mean, Mark, let me know if you know, in regards to the volume of disease with our papillary patients, how many of those were T1 versus TA high grade? Again, to that volume aspect, I don't think know too much about. And so to further contextualize that subgroup analysis kind of leaves me, you know, with, wow, well, because my initial thought would definitely be CIS patients should be in that really high risk category to think about. But interestingly, subgroup analysis in Potomac didn't show it what I would have thought.
Yeah, and we don't know. I haven't seen data that suggests what that breakdown is, Suzanne. I haven't seen what percentage of that papillary was T1 or TA. I know roughly 50% of the patients on Patopsco had T1. And so I know we tend to kind of put high-risk patients on those trials, but I don't actually haven't seen the data myself either. But yeah, I think it really just is that very high-risk phenotype, not just CIS, not just T1, but high-volume T1, unresectable T1, concomitant LVI, variant histology, repeat TURBT, more T1, you know, that kind of person that you really think should have cystectomy and they're just refusing. So yeah, I agree with everything Suzanne said.
Yeah. Look, I love this conversation. You know, I had a patient I was sharing with the academic center near my site, one of their urologists, and was seeing me for some reason in medical oncology. And, you know, when I first saw this data, I think, you know, I had the same impression that were discussed on this exact podcast, right? Well, single-digit benefit from a disease-free survival standpoint, probably not something that we should be using in all patients. And then I have a patient come through the door that has a ton of disease in the bladder. It's non-muscle invasive and a little bit of disease coming into the upper tracts, right? And so all of a sudden we're like, okay, this patient does not want to have a full GU-based surgery where we're taking out ureters and doing a cystectomy. But also, we can't give them, say, enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab either, right? And this was a patient where instantly I'm like, all of a sudden, I'm like, wait a second, how can we give them BCG and a checkpoint inhibitor? So I agree, these patients are out there. I do think it's all going to be about selection. And that's why it's critical that we have doctors like you two that can kind of demystify when urologists aren't comfortable giving checkpoint inhibitors, which they are in some areas of the country and they aren't in all areas of the country, how our medical oncologists can understand when they come to see us, when we say, yeah, 10% of the time, you're going to have an adverse event that's going to be potentially life-changing, right? If you take a checkpoint inhibitor. So how do we weigh the benefit risk of that when we're saying the benefits are no higher than the risk, right? So I think that's going to be a challenging where we really have to drill down to, yes, it's probably not for every patient that fit that trial design, even though that's the readout. But how do we actually, in the real world, use this? And it has to be some kind of higher risk than the high risk patient. And I do think when you start to drill it down, it does make sense. I don't know, Manoj, what are your thoughts from us two being the dumb medical oncologists on the call?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think we'll definitely see these patients, right? Because patients will think bladder cancer, they'll search online, they'll say you need a medical oncologist. And most oftentimes we can't really do much to help them because they need repeat TURBT or they need intravesical therapy of some sort, whether it be a chemotherapy combination or whether it be BCG, again, reinduction or so. And definitely had those conversations many times. And I work with Suzanne a lot and I'll send the patient back to her being like, I can't really help you. You need to see her to figure out what to do. And you're absolutely right. The toxicity risk and the benefit risk are very similar. And so really comes down to what is the alternative here in order to really figure out. And I definitely learned the cystectomy side of this, right? You know, when patients come to me and say, well, I was recommended a cystectomy, I was like, well, to me, it's like, well, there's a lot of new therapies that are coming out, right? Like we haven't talked about this, but you know, TAR is there. We haven't talked about nadofaragene, right? Like these are other therapies that are looked at in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. I know we kind of jumped to the immunotherapy side effect or immunotherapy combinations with BCG, but certainly there are these other class of drugs that are also utilized in your high-risk patients. So how do you put those drugs in context with your immunotherapy combinations with BCG and cystectomy or even radiation to figure out where do you go? I mean, I think that's where the integration of medical oncology and urology is super important. But I am curious to get the thoughts from Suzanne and Mark. You guys, how do you put, you know, drugs like TAR or even nadofaragene into the data of Potomac or CREST or anything else?
Well, they're two different spaces. So Potomac and CREST and Keynote 676, those are all in the BCG naive space, so first line setting. Most of the new drugs, intravesical drugs like nadofaragene, novopendekin, TAR-200, even Pembro from Keynote-057 is all in the BCG unresponsive space. So they meet that FDA criteria for having received already adequate BCG and then having a timing and pattern of recurrence that puts them at risk for kind of future failure of BCG or, you know, basically they're no longer eligible for ongoing BCG. And so that, I think, is an entirely different population. But we do have IO therapy agent in that space too. Pembrolizumab as a monotherapy. It's been studied in combination with gemcitabine as well. But it's FDA approved as a monotherapy for that BCG unresponsive space. And I will tell you, in my practice, and I think in the practice of most people, it's been relegated to the end, for all the reasons you just mentioned. You know, we have all these other agents that have very good efficacy signals, even better than what we saw in Keynote-057. Better in quotations, you know, they're basically all single arm open label studies. So hard to know which one is really better, but higher numerically complete response rates with a fraction of the grade 3 AEs. So I think, and that's a really area of ongoing debate. Suzanne and I have been on a number of discussions together where we're trying to see which one do you pick, which one do you use and whom and when. And it's kind of anybody's guess until we see phase 3 comparative data.
Yeah, I'm going to toss this over to Suzanne in a second because I want her thoughts on this. But, you know, the TARIS platform is like this plastic, right, catheter that goes into the bladder that elutes gemcitabine over a longer duration of time than saying just giving intravesical gemcitabine or intravesical, you know, taxane-based therapy. And then we have these other drugs, which are more immunogenic, right? So, Suzanne, can you kind of explain the MOA for somebody like me that has trouble explaining it? Can you kind of explain it, the differences maybe between the TARIS platform and some of these other drugs and then how you might go and think about selection between those agents?
Yeah, it's a good question. And there, which is great, there's been a lot of ingenuity over the past really decade trying to figure out how we can ultimately either better stimulate different stimulation of the immune system versus have better contact time of our cytotoxic agents with the urothelium. So that's where, again, TAR-200, again, they now call it the intervesical gemcitabine releasing system, is now the, you know, most up-to-date kind of nomenclature before this drug. And what that does is, you're absolutely right, so it is kind of a very flexible kind of plastic shape into a pretzel, two kind of quarters put together, okay, that unfurls, okay, has gemcitabine pellets in there, and there's holes within, of course, that plastic tubing, and that is unfurled, placed into the bladder through a catheter with a stylet pusher. And then once it gets into the bladder, it then curls into that pretzel formation and bobs around and is unable to be, you know, or very infrequently, rarely extracted naturally by the patient. And so it sits in there for about 3 weeks. And you know, again, allows this slow diffusion of gemcitabine into the bladder over that 3 week period of time. So by kind of day 21, 97% of that gemcitabine has completely diffused out. And the thought is, and kind of what it looks to be, that more continuous contact time of the cytotoxic agent versus our typical aqueous liquid form really allows for better, you know, effects, better cancer outcomes, reduction in recurrences, et cetera. So that's the mechanism of that, again, pretzel. The other drugs that are on the market, again, for BCG unresponsive high risk disease. So most of them have come out for CIS, but now have NCCN, again, approval, 2A approval for BCG unresponsive papillary disease now. All three do. The other two, again, nadofaragene and natopendicin. Natopendicin is given with BCG, so we'll start with that. That's a IL-15 super agonist. And basically, as it's given with BCG, these are both aqueous formations given via catheter into the bladder once a week for 6 weeks. Okay, so very similar administration and frequency to BCG. Ultimately, you know, just to say it basically, superpowers kind of the BCG. So makes, again, the BCG kind of work better, allowing a local immune response, again, to the bladder cancer. Of course, driven by the patient's own immune system. Whereas nadofaragene ultimately is a, you know, gene therapy, again, in an aqueous formation given via a catheter, but uniquely has a frequency every 3 months. And ultimately, what's really nice about that is the most infrequent administration that we have for our non-muscle invasive bladder cancer patients. So it becomes a very attractive, I will say, option for a number of reasons for our patients who, again, in this category, as Mark was saying, BCG unresponsive, these patients are usually elderly, their bladders have a lot of issue, frequency, urgency, incontinence. They're having their family members take them to visits. And to tell you the truth, why, again, pembrolizumab of all these agents has fallen, not only due to its, you know, lesser efficacious results, is that they're familiar with all these in the bladder therapies. One, getting an IV therapy is not something that they're used to, and is kind of, it's a detached scenario for them that they're not willing to necessarily jump to. And many times they have so many other comorbidities, you again worry about doing a systemic agent on them and risking those immune-related effects.
Super helpful. And I love the fact that we call it a super agonist. You know, I had heard that term too. How many times in medical oncology, Manoj, have we tried to take into our drug development units some kind of cytokine or something to make PD-1 therapy work again, and it just doesn't work, right? I love that it works in non-muscle invasive disease. I think it's quite an elegant approach to kind of soup up the BCG. I think that's a great way of describing it.
It also highlights to me that we're never going to really get away from BCG, right? I mean, I don't know that we are.
Yeah, Manoj, I will tell you one highlight and of this, again, all these BCG naive trials, CREST, Potomac, Albin, all showed us urologists that if you use BCG correctly, meaning very stringently, give that maintenance therapy. Now, in these trials, it was actually a short maintenance, only about, up to 2 years total therapy. BCG did great. And so all our historical data about, again, how BCG worked, this showed kind of like an improvement in the real era of better TURBTs, more, and again, stringent use of BCG, that it works really well.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry, Mark.
No, please.
No, I was just going to say, to me, it really highlights the importance of BCG, even in the era of shortages. I think we're looking at other options because of the shortages, but BCG is like, I mean, you should get BCG. I don't know. I mean, it seems that way to me, but hearing you guys talk about it is definitely reinforcing that to me. But certainly the very high risk that you're talking about earlier, there are that subcategory of patients who do need that additional benefit of immunotherapy is helpful to know. The question that I would have is, what do you do if you give them immunotherapy and BCG and then they're still relapsing locally? How would you approach them? But before you get there, Mark, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say, BCG absolutely is the backbone for non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, and it should be. It's inexpensive. It's well-tolerated. We have a lot of, experience with it. And so I think, I think it's a great thing that it's that way. The only thing I would just add to that is that we might see the BRIDGE study read out in a way that changes practice a little bit in this space. BCG is hard to get. Our practice runs out of it routinely. We dose reduce. We do 5 instead of 6 doses for induction, 2 instead of 3 for maintenance. We really would like to give more BCG. And if BRIDGE, which is a non-inferiority trial comparing gemcitabine intravesically in combination with docetaxel intravesically, if that reads out as non-inferior, then you might see more gemdosi use in the first line space. That has its own challenges in terms of there's a number of implementation barriers, especially for private groups, even for my group. Every now and then the nurses cry uncle on the gemdosi program because we don't have enough space to treat everybody with gemdosi. But it is a nice cheap alternative as well. Going to your question about what to do after the failure of IO therapy, so they go on BCG, let's say a very high risk patient goes on BCG IO therapy and then they fail. Well, I guess it depends a little bit on how they fail. If they fail sort of earlier in a BCG unresponsive way with a very high risk recurrence, then I'm really emphatically recommending cystectomy for the surgical candidates. But if they fail in a way that patients often fail, which is maybe just a little bit of CIS or a low volume, high grade TA, because of that, the vast majority of patients, we endoscopically clear them. And when they have a recurrence, 6 or 9 months later, it's usually not a big, bad recurrence. In that situation, I might consider bladder preservation with any of these agents that you mentioned earlier. There's a number of clinical trials that we're still doing in this space for BCG exposed and BCG unresponsive non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. And so I think actually the majority of people, you still could consider bladder preservation for. It just depends on what their path is at that TURBT.
And I guess, how many lines makes you nervous, right? So you tried BCG, maybe you tried Pembro, or maybe you tried one of these other intravesical. How far can we kick the can down the road before you just say enough is enough, let's do chemo radiation or surgery?
Suzanne?
I think great question, Ben. I mean, it's one that we are grappling with and unfortunately having to grapple with as there's so many agents available. Patients are aware of this. And usually once they're on the bladder sparing train and they know that there's all these new agents, they want to keep going. So it's really important for all of us urologists who are now have access to these new novel great therapies that we remain vigilant in doing updated scans when they recur, checking for extravesical disease, making sure that we are performing that good TURBT, understanding exactly their degree of disease in there, and counseling them that with each of these recurrences, their disease outsmarting these therapies, their risk of progressing, developing metastatic disease goes up. And so we are teetering, you know, kind of playing with fire. And so as long as they, I feel, understand you have, you know, clear CT scans, you have that good discussion with them, you're making, kind of shared decision-making with that patient. They understand the risks. They're going to follow up for their cystoscopies. You're not going to lose them to follow up. Again, you can go to depth, certainly two to possibly three. And then I think that's where it gets scary beyond there, but we don't really know how far we can go. And I will tell you, as we go forward in time, one of the things to mention here about decision-making on which agent to go to, that it's not just a grab bag, there's a lot that goes into the patient factors. And we have to also know, as we're going through these lines of therapy, the patient is also usually aging on us and becoming, unfortunately, many times less of a great, kind of cystectomy candidate as well. So that's weighing in our minds too, that are we losing this window of opportunity to safely take them for a curative surgery or curative therapy, actually. And so that plays into the discussion too, but I'll stop short there because ultimately we do not know.
Yeah. And I will say that I've heard some of my colleagues describe this space as a disease state where we shouldn't think about it in terms of lines of therapy. I don't know that I fully agree with that. I understand the point that they're making, which is at some point we're really, like Suzanne said, we're playing with fire and we need to start thinking about cystectomy sooner rather than later. But I'll tell you, the patients think about it still in terms of lines of therapy. And so it almost is kind of a moot point whether we do or we don't, because the patients are now requesting bladder preservation more and more aggressively, to the point where I do have patients that will have failed two, maybe three clinical trials and a couple of other intravesical standard of care therapies and still be hesitant to go to cystectomy. So I think the patients are thinking about it along those lines, Ben. So I think it's a great question.
Interesting. We're seeing the more bladder preservation, even in the muscle invasive disease, right? So even in muscle invasive disease, patients are asking about bladder preservation, even though we don't have strong evidence for that at this point. And we have very little data that shows that bladder preservation with just systemic therapy is going to be helpful or going to be enough. But that thought is even coming even into more advanced disease as well. How do you guys think about the immunotherapies in general? Do you think about durvalumab, sasanlimab, pembrolizumab all as similar? Do you think about them as different? How do you approach them, right? Like medical oncology, there's always been this thought that PD-1 versus PD-L1, Opdivo, or like, you know, nivolumab versus Keytruda versus like atezolizumab, we think they're all pretty similar across the board. Like the side effect profile and administrations are slightly different. But how do you guys view immunotherapies in general? Do you think about them being more similar than different? Do you really think that they're different in terms of management of toxicity and such?
I'm not sure I have enough experience with them in terms of management of their toxicities, because I still partner with our medical oncologists. But I do think that many in the urology community viewed sasanlimab as slightly different, just because I think there was a greater appetite for urologists to administer that themselves, just because it didn't require an infusion center and it was appealing from that perspective. I still think of them as all the same. I don't have any interest in managing their AEs, which I've seen adrenal insufficiency, type 1 diabetes a couple times. And we're talking about non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. So, sometimes you don't want the treatment to be worse than disease. So I mean, that's why I think we should be careful about who and whom we use it. But I generally think about them as all the same.
Would echo that too. Yeah, I think we look at it more, from the administration standpoint, as Mark said. So with Sansalmab being sub-Q, that was very attractive, for better or for worse, I will tell you, because it probably, if that would have come out alongside Durvalumab, definitely probably that would have been uptake higher just because of the administration being sub-Q. And I think it probably would have unfortunately caused a lot of practices to enter into this space not yet appropriately ready as urologists. And there was a lot of talk on how to get urologists ready, because there was going to be a lot of interest just because of an access standpoint. But yeah, I don't think from, yeah, PD-L1, PD-1 inhibitors, we don't think of it much difference, nor from the side effect profile either, whether from a disease standpoint. I mean, you know, if you kind of look at the, I don't know how much weight you guys put on this, but looking at the KM curve, you know, early split differences between Potomac versus Crest, if that, you know, was there, I know, could be the patient population, could have been, you know, could it have been the two different agents? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm going to agree. I think I wouldn't put too much differences on looking at the splits in the trials, which you're referring to. And in bladder cancer, I'm not sure PD-1 and PD-L1 makes a big difference. Obviously, they were designed to mitigate some of the toxicity risk of a PD-1 inhibitor. That's what a PD-L1 inhibitor was supposed to do. Being a ligand disruptor, not hitting all the same PD targets that, say, a traditional PD-1 checkpoint inhibitor hits. That being said, I'm not sure it manifests into a difference in efficacy in urothelial cancer. Obviously, we have metastatic approvals with avelumab. We've seen data where atezolizumab can be successful, even though it doesn't necessarily have a home right now in the United States for its use. And those are PD-L1 inhibitors. Obviously, pembrolizumab is a PD-1 inhibitor, and nivolumab is a PD-1 inhibitor with very clear guidance on how to use those in the current landscape. I do think they make a difference in kidney cancer. We've talked about that on other podcasts. And so it's probably a disease state focused on how some of these immune resistance can develop. I don't think anyone actually really truly knows. And it's all hypothetical, and it could all just be random variants with statistics, right, between some of those trials in kidney cancer that are seem to be different than urothelial cancer. I do think you make great points about the subcutaneous versus the IV infusions, right? Those urology groups that are giving IV checkpoint inhibitors are now very experienced at giving them, right? You know, you've been trained up for years on how to give immune therapy, and it's no different than a medical oncologist necessarily coming out of fellowship at this point. But obviously, when you move to sub-Q formulations, which they are all moving towards anyways at this point, you know, you potentially are going to get some that have less of that experience starting to give it. I think that's going to happen no matter what. And I think it's important that when we think about patient access as well to change to these formulations, we just need to make sure that we give the guidance and the education to make sure that whether it's a medical oncologist or a urologist, or maybe in the future, a dermatologist in other disease states, right? Giving these therapies that they're able to at least know how to use them, or be able to phone a friend if they run into issues. And I want to ask Mark, you know, a question, right? Because we've talked a lot about therapy, and you've mentioned that you co-manage these with medical oncology, and right? And I think most of the people who listen to this podcast are not at traditional academic centers or university centers, right? They are treating patients with solid tumor oncology indications, right? A lot of them GU cancer patients, and they're sharing patients with urologists and trying to figure out how do we co-manage the responsibility of managing a patient that, say, might be on a BCG with a checkpoint inhibitor. So I'd love for you to walk through with us how that might happen. Who sees the patient? How does that referral go? And then when you're seeing the patient, who takes on the responsibility of communication for a side effect that might be from both, say like a cystitis or, you know, some kind of renal insufficiency? How do you co-manage that in the real world in your practice?
I think the vast majority of patients are going to be still primarily managed by me, even when they're getting combination IO therapy. So I'm still doing their cystoscopies regularly. I've generally known them for a lot longer anyway. And, you know, my nurses are seeing them every week given BCG versus every 3 or 4 weeks with the IO therapy. And so I still think it generally, most of the stuff kind of falls back on the urologist. And then practically in the real world, what we do was that, and then I reach out to the medical oncologist when there's an issue. You know, the labs generally come to me as well, even the, you know, the TSH, hey, TSH is a little off, what do you think? And then they kind of manage it, tell us where we're going to dial down the IO therapy, maybe start steroids. And I defer all of that to them. But I think the urologist in the non-muscle invasive bladder cancer space should still be the starting point for the communication between the patient and the team. And then when there are questions, should be the starting point for communication between the medical oncologist and the urologist. I feel very differently in the muscle invasive or metastatic space, but I think for non-muscle invasive, that's generally, I think, probably the best setup for patients.
And Suzanne, I'm now going to ask you, you give checkpoint inhibitors, right? So I imagine you hold on to most of your patients. I imagine, though, that there's a subset of patients at your urology group in Colorado that do refer out to some of Manoj's colleagues, right, at Rocky Mountain Cancer Center. So how do you feel that responsibility and that communication should flow in a community-based environment?
Yeah. So the patients that Manoj and I share, or with I share with some of his colleagues, it really is as simple as I pretty much have a lot of their cell phones and text them. So if it is patient we share and it's again side effect that could be caused by systemic therapy or could be caused by again something that I'm administering, it's just a starts off with just a conversation between the two providers on, again, how to handle it. Now, for those patients that I house completely internally within our urology clinic and we're administering checkpoint inhibitors, we have, had to set up kind of a dedicated team to manage these patients. So it's not only, our nurse infusionist, it's kind of our advanced therapy coordinator. We have dedicated PAs that only manage and see these patients who receive this therapy and have a system set up from, checking on symptoms when we see them, labs regularly, so people know the protocol, imaging that's done regularly, phone calls that happen a day or two later after receiving the infusions, all this sort of stuff, so we can really keep track of it. And then we have kind of a dedicated list of referrals, from the endocrinologist, the dermatologist, the gastroenterologist, et cetera, et cetera. And then we've become pretty comfortable with, again, knowing how to grade these toxicities, feeling comfortable administering prednisone, and then knowing when we personally need to step it up for not only the referrals, but, like an inpatient admission or something like that. And I know that, with how friendly Manoj is, if I do ever run into trouble, I'm not sure what I'm looking at, I know he would field my call, even though it might not be a patient of his. So he's kind of always my last resource to use is your medical oncologist, your local medical oncologist. If you have a good relationship with them, I'm sure you can, phone a friend and ask, gosh, have you ever seen this? What should I do in that sort of scenario? As well, for those that are, doing this themselves.
Absolutely. Suzanne, you can call me anytime. How could I help?
I think these are great conversations. And the most interesting thing that I've heard, outside of all this exciting data is Mark's comment. He wants to be the quarterback on all non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. And I don't think there's anything wrong or right about that. I think a lot of medical oncologists come out of fellowship and they have this bias or this thought that they're going to be the quarterback for any patient they see. They're trained in internal medicine. They're going to do all these things and they can manage everything. But I think the key is it's communication and delineation of responsibility. So you need to have that relationship with that partner of yours in urology or medical oncology so that you know who's the point of contact, who's the quarterback of that patient. As long as there's an identified person who's managing the day-to-day, and then the other person is managing whatever they're managing, this works, right? And it takes time to establish those relationships. I know when I left MD Anderson to come to Nashville, it took years to actually really understand, okay, urologist A wants this, urologist B wants this, urologist C wants that, right? And everything was a little bit different and I was comfortable in all of those relationships. And then over time, things started to merge to be more similar than different. But I think the key was cell phones, collaboration, constant communication, and just be willing to be available, right? And that's how I think this works. And I think it doesn't matter how you do it, as long as you realize that this is a multidisciplinary effort, even when we don't necessarily have the same university setting that we trained under where everyone's in the same roof, right? Now we're different practices, sometimes with competing interests, though I never like to think of it that way, but that's the inherent nature of the business of medicine these days. But how do we come together to keep the patient first and that communication stream open so that we can be collegial, collaborative, and actually really raise the care in community oncology and community urology so that we're, you know, equals with our academic centers and perhaps in the future, and this is, you know, Sarah Cannon Research Institute's goal, better, right? So anyways, Manoj, what thoughts do you have before we conclude?
I actually don't know that I could say anything better than what you just said. And I think this conversation really highlights that, right? I mean, we have a great relationship with urology. We communicate all the time. If there's questions for, even for medical oncology, I'll call Suzanne and be like, Suzanne, what do you think about this? What do you think about the role of surgery for any of these more advanced patients, right? So I think that relationship goes both ways, not only in the non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, but also in the more advanced disease, right? Especially in the era of newer drugs, especially EVP. Right. We're seeing some phenomenal responses now. We've never thought about these locally advanced disease patients as getting consolidative surgery, but now it's going to shift the landscape, right? Like, do you think about radiation? Do you think about surgery for these patients to really get them to that point of quote unquote cure when you're having that kind of response? So this communication and partnership with medical oncology and urology extends beyond the non-muscle invasive disease. But I agree with Mark. I think urology is the quarterback for the non-muscle invasive disease. They definitely see those patients and they are the ones that manage this. And quite honestly, I think they know a lot more than I do about the non-muscle invasive.
5%.
Yeah. No, I agree with everything that's been said so far. So yeah, I don't think I have anything else. I don't know if Suzanne or Mark, you guys have any additional thoughts on non-muscle invasive bladder cancer or anything else that we're talking about.
Yeah, the pipeline's very exciting. We didn't really talk much about the pipeline. In just for your listeners, in non-muscle invasive, we talked a little bit about TAR-200. It's now starting to, just got a J-code last month, starting to kind of get pick up steam clinically in the real world. We talked about nadofaragene and novopendekin in combination with BCG. But in the pipeline is another drug called cretostimogene, grenadenorepvec. It's a oncolytic immunotherapy, an Ad5, an adenovirus-based gene therapy that replicates only in RBE pathway-deficient tumor cells. And the CR rates have been very good and very promising, all with no grade 3s and no treatment-related discontinuation. So be on the lookout for that one. I think, you know, the new drug application was submitted to the FDA, and, you know, I don't know when the FDA is going to make a decision on that, but I would hope sometime over the next year, we would see that available clinically as well. And there's some other drugs in this space, which are a little behind cretostimogene that Suzanne and I work on together. And the detalimogene is one, and TARA-002 is another, both being studied in the BCG unresponsive CIS population as well. So I'm really excited. And then candidly, there's a bunch of others too that are still kind of in the earlier setting. We're still collecting some early data, but I'm very excited about this space. And I think there's a lot of exciting development even to come still.
Just say, piggyback on what Mark said, is that we're finally making kind of moves in both non-muscle invasive and muscle invasive disease, which is just really exciting. There just has not been that great of movement from our typical therapies in both those spaces for quite some time. And we are it's just amazing. And so it's very exciting for us as providers, of course, for our patients. And yeah, some of these really novel delivery systems that are coming out in the non-muscle invasive space are not only it's making a difference from a drug standpoint, but from a quality of life standpoint for our patients, not having to come in, you know, every week and get a therapy necessarily. And it's really also potentially improving the cancer outcomes with these different novel drug systems that we're coming up with. So it's just awesome. So very exciting time to be a part of this.
Awesome. Well, I certainly learned a lot today, Ben. Usually I have a lot of key takeaways, and today I think I learned a lot about the exciting things that's happening in the non-muscle invasive space, and certainly the relationships between medical oncology, urology, and then even the how we sequence the drugs, right? You know, when you think about all these drugs in the non-muscle invasive, I think one of the things that is easy to forget the role of BCG, right? And how important BCG is. And I think today it's reinforcing all of those things. You want to sign us out, close us out? I definitely want to thank our guests for joining and taking so much time to go over this with us. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, no, Thank you both so much. Very helpful. Helped me a lot. I'm sure it helped a lot of our listeners. If you have any questions, please email us at podcast@oncologydakota.com. Tweet at us on X, however you want to communicate it with us. That's fine. LinkedIn, whatever. We're happy to engage with any questions or comments that you have. And I'll sign off with two things. You know, my first thought is if you want to forget about BCG, become a medical oncologist and not a urologist, you don't have to give it. And the second thing is we should probably consider putting EVP in a pretzel and see where that goes. But with all that being said, thanks, everyone. And we look forward to ASCO, where we can all reconnect with our colleagues.